Today we speak with Dr. Albert Garcia Romeo. He is a member of the Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences faculty at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He studies the effects of psychedelic drugs in humans, with a focus on psilocybin as an aid in the treatment of addiction. He received his doctorate in 2012 from the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, where he researched self-transcendence and meditation and their role in mental health. His current research interests include clinical applications of psychedelics, mindfulness, and altered states of consciousness, and their underlying neurobiological and psychological mechanisms. I am so excited to have him on the show because of our mutual interest in psychedelics and their potential for mental health. I also work on clinical trials with psilocybin as a facilitator at Pacific Neuroscience Institute and have found the entire premise of psychedelic therapy rooted in the ability to tap into a patient's inner healing wisdom. This is a very different concept from our current conventional mental health model. We'll talk about the history of psychedelics, the potential indications for mental health treatment, as well as Dr. Garcia's thoughts on psychedelic use for personal consciousness exploration. Welcome. Can we just start off what psychedelics are, why you're drawn to them, and how you got in this field?
Yeah, psychedelics is kind of a big umbrella term that's used to talk about a lot of different types of substances, but also experiences. It's funny, I was talking about this with some pharmacists today, but the word psychedelic was coined in 1957, so this is not a word that's been around that long. And it was specifically invented by Dr. Humphrey Osmond, who was doing research with psychedelics at the time, and specifically was talking about drugs like LSD and mescaline, which they were kind of becoming part of the psychiatric research, armamentarium at the time. There's a lot of interest in these psychedelics right around 1950s, 1960s. And particularly LSD, it had a lot of research around it in those days. And when people were first studying these drugs, they were calling them all sorts of different things, including things like psychotomimetics, as well as hallucinogens, which is still a common term is used today. And even fantastica was a term that was thrown around early in the 20th century. So it really shows that there's a variety of conceptualizations around these substances. But when we're talking about the classic psychedelics, as we now refer to them, we're generally talking about drugs that affect the serotonin system, specifically as agonists at the serotonin 2A receptor. They also work on other serotonin, other types of serotonin receptors. They also work on, other neurotransmitter systems that we know. Drug by drug, it varies, but some of these have a really long history of traditional use, going back thousands of years. And that would include psilocybin, which is found in about 200 species of mushrooms that grow all over the world. And indigenous cultures, have artifacts and archaeological findings that show a kind of a revered status of these mushrooms, again, up to 3,500 or more years ago. And we see things like cave paintings depicting these types of mushrooms and use of them. There's also cacti such as San Pedro and peyote, which contain mescaline. And of course, DMT or dimethyltryptamine, which is found in certain types of plants and has been used in indigenous cultures. For instance, in making ayahuasca, which is a sort of a sacramental substance that's found in South America. And so there, psychedelics have been around longer than we have because many of them are found in plants and fungi. But then humans have started to use those as we do. We seek out different ways of altering our consciousness. And so there's kind of this long and interesting history of the way that they have been interwoven with cultures, different cultures in different times and different parts of the world. And even if you go back, to the early 20th century, you go to 1902 and there's a Popular Science article about mescaline. And so, you know, scientists even back at the turn of the 19th to 20th century were interested in this stuff. And today we're kind of back at that place. There was a bit of a lull, particularly after the 1960s, when a lot of these substances were associated with the counterculture. We had this big war on drugs that was started during the early 1970s, sort of as a backlash to the cultural upheaval of the 1960s. And I always say, you know, Woodstock was 1969. 1970, basically, psychedelics are outlawed in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And then the ripple is 1971, psychedelics and cannabis are outlawed pretty much internationally around the world. And so you really saw some concern about the risks that these substances pose and, you know, what they could potentially mean for perhaps bigger power systems. But, you know, these psychedelics and, you know, the term psychedelic was meant to elicit their property of being quote unquote mind manifesting. And that was what Dr. Osmond observed when he was studying LSD and mescaline and administering it to patients and also using it himself, that he found it to sort of manifest the latent contents of the mind to sort of bring up what you may think of as unconscious material or bits of our brain functioning that is not always right away immediately visible. We're becoming apparent when people were taking these drugs. So I still like the term, but it does have a lot of loaded cultural baggage. So I think that was covering the first bit of the question, which is what are psychedelics? And in terms of, I think the second part was what drew me to them.
Yeah, how'd you get into it?
Mm-hmm. So I've been interested in both just regular Western psychology and philosophy and, you know, just trying to understand the mind and the reason that we're here. And you know, so I was kind of reading and studying broadly as a young man, both in Western psychology and philosophy. And people like Abraham Maslow, I think, you know, had a big formative impact on me. And, you know, thinking about things like self-actualization in specific, how do we become the best versions of ourselves? And that also overlaps somewhat with what you might consider altered states of consciousness or different ways that we can experience ourselves in the world, which in our, you know, 21st century materialist culture tends to be downplayed or thought of as pathological many times. But in other cultures, there can be uses for altered states of consciousness. And you can think of traditions that include things like ecstatic dance, shamanic types of rituals, you know, different ways of experiencing ourselves that you know, really fall outside of what we think of as the normal mindset, you know, in our current culture. And that really got me interested in learning more about altered states and studying also Eastern spirituality and wisdom traditions like Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, which include a lot of techniques that are specifically designed to change the way that we're interacting with the contents of our mind. So meditation is, you know, kind of another one of these big umbrella terms that we use to talk about a lot of different types of practices. Sometimes they're considered more on the spiritual side. Other times they can be thought of almost exclusively as cognitive exercises or attention training exercises. And so, you know, I really began studying meditation and altered states of consciousness out of my own curiosity as I kind of moved through my undergraduate career. I spent many years after coming out of college, not really knowing where I wanted to focus and just doing odd jobs for the time being and still reading a lot. And that kind of brought me back to my interest in finding the intersection between the way that we think about the mind, the brain, and consciousness in Western science, which were, you know, largely predicated on psychological theory, but also neuroscience, understanding of things like neurotransmitters and hormones. And so I studied that pretty deeply in undergraduate, but also trying to bring to bear some of the different conceptualizations of consciousness and the mind that you get when you are studying something like Buddhism or engaging in a formal meditation practice. And when you actually have some of these firsthand experiences doing meditation or, you know, having other altered states of consciousness, which can come from fasting, can come from different types of practices like prayer, as well as, you know, ingesting psychoactive substances, including psychedelics, but also, you know, alcohol is I think a classic example. Then, you know, that brought me back around to my graduate school program that really focused intensively on a sort of holistic understanding of the self, a sort of mind-body-spirit approach to psychology. And that was what drew me to go to this program at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, which is in Palo Alto, California, or at least it was when I went there. It's been since been bought and has changed hands and is a little bit of a different program now, but it's still there in Palo Alto under the name of Sophia University. But yeah, that was what kind of brought me there, is I had these somewhat broad ranging interests that encompass, you know, altered states, meditation, you know, mind and consciousness, and, you know, how we could understand that from a sort of multi-level perspective. And ITP, you know, was one of the few places where they were thinking about things in those, you know, broad terms and really seriously considering not only the spiritual aspects of what people can experience and how they can have those types of altered states of consciousness, but also bringing to bear more of our traditional Western psychology and psychotherapy orientations. So putting all those pieces together was what attracted me there. And that was what I set out to do when I went to graduate school in California back in 2007.
Amazing. Thank you for breaking that down. I feel as I'm hearing you talk, it reminds me of this Carl Jung quote where he says, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. And I feel like a lot of these you know, as you're saying about psychedelics, and not necessarily just psychedelics, there's other ways to get to these unconscious states, meditation, fasting, prayer, you know, those are an interesting avenue that we need to delve into kind of these deeper spaces. And I think that the work you guys have done at Johns Hopkins has really changed how we look at psychedelics. And I feel like the underlying treatment model of psychedelics is vastly different than our current mental health models. Whereas, you know, current mental health models, there's a lot of talk therapy, psychoanalysis, but for psychedelics, there's extensive time spent on set and setting preparation. After taking the psychedelic medication, there's extensive integration back into normal life. And I think one of the most incredible things is that during the treatment session with psychedelics, as I was saying, there's not much therapy going on. And there's this huge emphasis on what's called the inner healing wisdom. And that if something difficult comes up during that session, in a sense, it needed to come up. And, you know, that participant is encouraged to kind of go into that feeling as that inner wisdom of the mind knows that this is what needs to be processed now. And it's interesting that most participants usually are encouraged to, you know, keep headphones on that have like beautifully curated music and, you know, eye shades to really facilitate staying inside the mind. Can you elaborate a little bit on the psychedelic model?
Yeah, and that's a great seg into, you know, how do we use these substances in a mental health care setting, or at least, you know, for research purposes so far. And what you're describing is really harkening back to some of the early psychedelic research that was taking place in the 1960s. And there were groups that were working on this all over the world, you know, that administered LSD and other psychedelics to diverse patient populations to try to understand if they had any therapeutic benefits and what, if any, were the mental processes that were involved in these drugs, or what were they kind of eliciting. And, you know, there was a couple of models that really came out of that, one being what they call a psycholytic model of treatment. That was much more based on an approach where people would be doing talk therapy during their drug sessions, as well as kind of before and after. And then that would typically use lower doses, which would allow the person to maintain their faculties so that they could have a coherent conversation. But then, of course, the therapist would be sort of guiding that or driving that in some way towards a therapeutic insight or some other process that would be helpful to the patient. That was largely practiced in Europe, but there are practitioners all over using the psycholytic models. And, you know, I think that had a lot to do with the popularity at the time of Freudian psychoanalytic tradition that was still sort of the basis for talk therapy when these psychedelics were just becoming more popularized in research. There was also a school that emerged, which we call just plainly psychedelic therapy, that focused on having these sort of big transcendent or peak experiences that didn't really have as much to do with the therapist and was more kind of opening up the person to something that was perhaps already inside of themselves. And by using higher doses of these psychedelics and providing a safe container or space for them to have that type of experience, and then helping them to, as you mentioned, sort of reintegrate that into their life afterwards. That was one of the approaches that seemed to have the most promise for clinical use. And that included, as you noted, screening procedures where we kind of make sure that this person is safe and in the right mindset to go through this type of experience, preparatory phase where there would be counseling or therapy beforehand, focusing on the presenting problem, getting to know the person, building a sense of rapport and trust, and then going through the dosing sessions. During that session, most of the time you would see a lot less of this directive talk therapy and a lot more of generally what we do is sit back, allow the person to have an experience without any sort of real direction from us, with the exception of, if they're having a very difficult experience or they're very anxious or afraid, we can help lend a hand so that they can get through that. But otherwise, we are generally sitting back quietly and, making sure that the person is safe and comfortable. And when the drug wears off, we begin a process of integration that, doesn't just take place over the course of that day or a few days after, but typically for several weeks or even months afterwards, we would continue to engage with the person and their therapeutic process to sort of see what the experience brought up for them, how in any way, how it could be useful for them, or if in any way they had gotten some sort of insight or lessons that they feel they would like to kind of bring back with them from that experience. So that's the sort of model that we're using, generally speaking, when we're talking about high-dose psychedelic treatment, particularly for things like mood disorders and addictions, where there's been probably the most work in the last 20 years. But I think this is also such an interesting area because there is so much we don't know yet, because the kind of overall taboo and restrictions on doing research with psychedelics between 1970 and probably the mid-90s made it so that there was very little, if any, work done. Since the mid-90s, we've seen kind of a slow and gradual upheaval where there's all of a sudden now all this work happening here at Hopkins and elsewhere, all over the country and even, in different parts of the world. And so I think this is going to allow us to get a better understanding for how these drugs may be used clinically and other ways that have nothing to do with that psychedelic therapy model. And for instance, I just mentioned this earlier today, but Dr. Emanuelle Schindler is at Yale. She just published a nice paper showing that lower doses of psilocybin specifically were helpful for people that were struggling with migraines. And that's not something that necessarily necessitates that sort of talk therapy model. But I think it really depends on what kind of dosing are you using, what's the substance, what's the target indication and population that you're working with. So it's an exciting time for the field because we have so much to learn, and I think there are so many places that we can apply these, even at, you know, potentially very much lower doses, that could have some real benefit for people. For instance, you know, having anti-inflammatory properties, you know, having properties that can help create new connections in the brain cells in, you know, key areas like the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. So that's what a lot of the new preclinical work looking at our biological mechanisms are showing. But then, you know, you also have all this other really fascinating work about these experiences that people can have, which have been termed mystical, transcendent, and sometimes spiritual as well. But, you know, these very highly meaningful experiences that people come back with, which can give us a lot of leverage for doing a sort of therapeutic process when you're dealing with an existential distress at the end of life, when you're dealing with, you know, a major depressive disorder, or you're dealing with a substance use disorder, for instance.
Thank you for explaining that. What you were talking about at the end about, you know, anxiety, maybe about terminal illness, it reminds me of something I had read that was so profound. I think it was one of the most beautiful passages I had read in any of the psychedelic literature I've looked at. It was the work that Charlie Grobe had done with cancer patients that had this, you know, large amount of anxiety that they just could not function from because they knew that their life was imminently ending. And there was one excerpt, I kind of want to just read a couple lines from it. I'm sure you've probably heard about it, but I think about this quote a lot. And it was from a patient named Patrick. He had a metastatic lung cancer. And once he finishes his journey, he just was told to kind of journal about like how he felt. And I have the passage here. He said, "From here on, love was the only consideration. Everything that happened, anything and everything that was seen or heard, centered on love. And it was the only purpose. Love seemed to emanate from a single point of light. It was so pure. The sheer joy, the bliss was indescribable. And in fact, there are no words to accurately capture my experience, my state, this place. I know I've had no earthly pleasure that comes close to this feeling, no sensation, no image of beauty. Nothing during my time on this earth has felt as pure and joyful and glorious as the height of this journey. I was beginning to wonder if man spent too much time and effort at things unimportant, trying to accomplish so much when really it was all so simple. No matter the subject, it all came down to the same thing, love. Earthly matters such as food, music, architecture, anything, everything aside from love seemed silly and trivial. I thought about my cancer, but only briefly. I took a tour of my lungs. I could see some things, but it was more a matter of feeling the inside of my lungs. I remember breathing deeply to help facilitate the seeing. There were nodules, but they seemed rather unimportant. I was being told without words not to worry about the cancer. It's a minor scheme of things, simply an imperfection of your humanity, and that the more important matter, the real work to be done, is before you. Again, love. Undoubtedly, my life has changed in ways I may never fully comprehend, but I now have an understanding, an awareness that goes beyond intellect, that my life, that every life, and all that is the universe equals one thing, love." What do you think about that, Albert?
You know, first of all, I think that's a great example of the type of experience people will come back and report with these high dose sessions. And, you know, really a big fan of Charlie and his work. And actually one of my colleagues from ITP from graduate school was one of the folks who was running that study back there at UCLA many years ago. And yeah, I think it's a great exemplar of what we talk about when we mention mystical or peak or transcendent experiences. It really almost brings you to this sort of 30,000 foot view of life and reality and, you know, what is the purpose of my existence? And that is helpful when you are needing to let go of maybe some, you know, grudges or petty concerns or things that perhaps you were very kind of focused on in the moment. But, you know, when you're looking at it from the big picture, is less than important. And so putting things in perspective, I think, is a huge strength of these types of experiences that people can have using psychedelics. And it's difficult to convey that, I think, without hearing the type of story that you noted. But that's, you know, it's something that we've heard so many of the people that we work with say something very similar, you know, that they have this feeling of what's really important, these feelings of deep love, gratitude, connectedness to people and to themselves and to nature, you know, in ways that they haven't really experienced in a long time or ever. And so that type of experience can be so transformative. And for palliative care, it's really, I think, a game changer, because there, you know, we're not trying to necessarily affect the course of the treatment there in terms of how is a person's life going to, you know, move in the future. But what you are changing is the sort of quality of that life for the time that they have left. And by having that shift in perspective internally, then they can go ahead and enjoy, you know, what time that they do have left, as well as perhaps kind of reestablish some connections with people that they care about. And I've seen this before where, you know, you had a argument with a loved one. You know, I haven't talked to my brother in 40 years, that kind of thing. And you're also dealing with a you know, terminal illness, and say, well, I realize now, whatever we were arguing about 40 years ago is not that important. You know, I really should probably talk to that guy. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a ton of potential there for this type of work, not just, you know, for people who are at the end of life, but people who are in the midst of life still. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it kind of just brings up, and maybe just something personally for me, just going through medical school and residency, you know, there really is not an emphasis on, I know there's we talk about the art of living, but not really about the art of dying. And I think there's so much discomfort on that very subject. And it's such an important thing to address, because a lot of times as doctors, we're just trying to salvage more time, more life, but is that really quality? You know, is that really getting to something that actually has meaning for the patient? You know, we can add a couple weeks or months, but if those weeks or months are filled with, you know, this dread and anxiety and not really having this kind of this profound experience that I just read, maybe what's the benefit? You know, should we really be looking at this more holistic approach? And I also kind of think about, you know, and this is what I want to ask you, when we see people that are starting to learn about psychedelics and they're like, you know, I'm curious, but I still have so many reservations, you know, like what's happening in the brain? Is it addictive? Could something happen to me? Are there any downsides? How do you kind of answer those patients?
Yeah, those are great and important questions. I think of psychedelics as something that has a lot of potential to help people, but at the same time, it's not for everyone. Just like if you grabbed 100 people off the street and asked them, you know, have you gone skydiving, and would you like to? Many of them are going to say no. And so I think of this type of treatment as not exactly the same, but related in a way. I mean, for many years, the people who were going out and using psychedelics more on a sort of underground level, not in necessarily medical trials or medical settings, tended to be what you might think of as thrill seekers, or what we sometimes call psychonauts, people who are attempting to explore their own minds. And that is a particular stripe of person, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. But what's very interesting in the current zeitgeist is you're seeing a shift in terms of how we think of these things. Again, in indigenous cultures, you know, they had their own sort of role and place in the culture. But in, you know, what we're seeing now in the sort of modern Western culture, the way that we had conceptualized psychedelics was mainly as drugs of abuse or things that people were using recreationally. But that can also go along with other really dangerous drugs like cocaine or heroin that can kill you. And now we're seeing this sort of movement towards accepting these, or at least thinking about accepting these as potential medical treatments. And so that's going to look very different in terms of the application, and also attract a different crowd. And many of these people may be folks who have gone through traditional medical treatments and have had a hard time getting the type of relief that they're seeking for intractable conditions like addictions and depression and other mental health issues that they may have been struggling with, post-traumatic stress. And you know, even still within that subgroup, I don't think this is going to help everyone, but it certainly has a lot of potential to help many people. And so that's why we're enthusiastic about kind of bringing these out there to where they can be more accessible. But are there risks? Yeah, there's risks to pretty much any sort of treatment. And with the classic psychedelics in specific, though, the risks seem to be pretty low, especially when you implement some safeguards, which is what we've been doing at Hopkins. You know, Ron Griffiths and the team here started doing this work with psilocybin, you know, back when I was basically in high school. And, you know, I got here a few years later in 2012. And, you know, I've been working here since then. But, you know, the sort of protocols that we use to administer these drugs in a medical setting make them pretty darn safe because we're doing a very careful screening ahead of time to make sure that the person doesn't have any contraindications. There's no medical or psychiatric conditions that put them at a vulnerable position where they could develop long-term adverse sequelae or neuropsychiatric symptoms, which are possible in certain folks. And you know, we know that certain people who are either they have a personal history of psychotic illness or symptoms, or they have a family history of that type of condition, may be vulnerable to those types of symptoms, and they may develop them after high dose exposure. And so we are very careful about screening those people so that they're not put in any risky situations. Same with conditions like bipolar mood. You know, there's a possibility that people who have a predisposition to bipolar mood may have adverse consequences of a high dose psychedelic administration, such as, you know, developing manic symptoms or having a full-blown manic episode. And so that's something that also we're very careful about. But physiologically, the drugs are incredibly safe. And when I say the drugs, I mean the classic psychedelics such as LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, DMT, ayahuasca. You know, you can take a fairly large dose of these drugs without causing any sort of harm to any of the major organ systems of the body. You know, the toxicity of them in terms of the physical and physiological harms are almost null. I mean, there's really very little there to be concerned about, with, you know, a few exceptions. A person may have a heart condition that may put them at risk of having a cardiovascular adverse event during a drug session. And so we're very careful about that. We conduct EKGs with everyone that we see and make sure that they're all clear there. And, you know, in terms of are these substances addictive, it's interesting if you go to the DSM, which is, you know, American Psychiatric Association's sort of book of disorders, you know, you'll look at the hallucinogens and specifically these psychedelics, and they do not actually create a withdrawal syndrome. And it's one of the few classes of drugs we know of that don't do that, meaning that when people take them, they develop a rapid tolerance. Such that the drug is no longer really effective if you take it continuously over and over again. And then, you know, that also means that when people stop taking them, they don't have a withdrawal syndrome that kind of pushes them to continue taking more. So physiologically, we don't really think of these as substances of, you know, dependence or addiction. And that's also consistent with the animal literature, where oftentimes you can put animals in, you know, special environments where they have access to certain types of addictive substances. And if you give them that access, then they'll continue to use those substances over and over again. And that's true for drugs like cocaine or opioids or alcohol, but not true for something like LSD, you know, one of those types of classic psychedelics where, generally speaking, these animals are not going to continue to self-administer the drug because they don't find it necessarily pleasurable or fun, if you want to think of it in those terms. So yeah, I mean, I think the main risk for a lot of people are more about the acute effects, which is during the drug session, you may have some uncomfortable psychological experiences that you may or may not be prepared for. And for some people with pre-existing vulnerabilities, that could set off longer term problems in terms of mental health issues that could persist beyond the drug experience itself. However, for most people who have a challenging experience acutely when they're under the influence, We were able to manage that pretty well with just interpersonal support of the session facilitators who are there with the person and who have built a strong working relationship with them. And then with integration and aftercare, where we try to make sense of what was that experience about? Why did that come up? What did it mean? And, you know, how can we get some insight or some valuable takeaway from that? And that tends to be more or less enough to kind of mitigate any serious harm from those experiences. And of course, you know, again, we're providing a safety boundary where people may, you know, who become disoriented aren't going to, you know, run out into traffic or do something untoward.
So I feel like I hear you saying that, you know, this war on drugs, maybe there's some drugs that there should still be a war on, you know, like heroin and cocaine, but everything else that got pooled under this, we may need to reevaluate, because, you know, a Schedule One drug is something with a very high addictive potential. And all this research we're seeing is showing that a lot of these classic psychedelics don't have this addictive potential, and they possibly have so much of a medical potential. And I also hear you saying how important, you know, this set and setting is, like doing this with intention and creating a very safe space so that mentally your mind can kind of go into these spaces that need further exploration. And I see you guys have been researching a lot on anxiety, depression, addiction, and you personally helped complete the first human laboratory study of a psychedelic for smoking cessation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, that's something I've been working on a lot for the last 9.5 years I've been here. Just to go back briefly, though, I know you mentioned the war on drugs and Schedule One substances, and some of them, you know, are very dangerous and others are not so much. You know, I agree with you 100% that the psychedelics are not nearly as dangerous as other drugs of abuse like cocaine or methamphetamine or opioids. But I also just want to mention that when you're talking about a war on drugs, you're really talking about a war on drug users. Mm-hmm. Many of them are people who are disenfranchised. They may be, you know, dealing with upbringings that are less than ideal, to put it nicely. You know, they may be struggling with things like physical or sexual abuse. And so they're not, you know, choosing to use these substances because that's what they want to do, but sometimes it's almost a coping mechanism. And so I really don't think criminalization of any sort of drug use is helpful at all. I think it's a health problem that should be treated such. So if a person is in possession of or using drugs that are currently Schedule One or illegal, regardless of how risky we might consider them, I don't think putting that person in jail is going to help them in any way. And in fact, it generally tends to make it more likely that they're going to continue to use drugs and engage in criminal activity. And in places like Portugal, where they've taken a decriminalization stance on lots of different types of drugs, pretty much all of the ones that are out there, that means when people are caught using these drugs, they're not sent to a you know, punitive system where they're going to be punished, but they're linked up with resources for healthcare and mental health care that can help them if they're motivated to make changes in that use. But yeah, I have a problem with the war on drugs because it ends up, I think, causing a lot more harm than good. Yeah, so that's just something I wanted to mention.
I actually completely agree with you. I think we don't look at the underlying trauma that caused the person to almost dysregulate in a particular way that causes so much pain and suffering that they go to this, you know, drug to just minimize the pain. You know, we're not asking why these people are drawn to this, because you're right, there is... there's a reason there, and it's very easy to just label it as you're a criminal and done. I'm not going to even think about it, but you're absolutely right. There's an underlying trauma there that if we address that, then maybe the coping mechanism of the disease will be a lot more safely dealt with.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to what you asked about previously with the tobacco work, I mean, we're looking at alcohol kills about 90,000 people a year in the U.S., tobacco kills about 500,000 people a year in the U.S. and more than 5 million people a year around the world. Those are perfectly legal, by the way. So I can just walk down to the corner store and buy them now. And so why is that? You know, this is all different types of cultural programming we have around what substances are okay and what substances are not okay, and also what types of states of consciousness are considered acceptable. So when we talk about altered states, being awake and sober and alert and sitting here drinking my Starbucks is considered in a, capitalist society, a very productive and, useful type state of consciousness. But when you're talking about a person who's, using heroin or psychedelic, that's a completely different type of altered state that is often thought of as less or, less valuable or less acceptable. But I mean, how often do you see people, having regular happy hours with their coworkers, beer commercials? People, have accepted by and large in Western culture use of alcohol, caffeine, and tobacco in ways that we know cause, not the caffeine so much, but with the alcohol and the tobacco, cause huge health, public health problems. And, they're still perfectly legal and completely accessible. So, I think, again, it calls into question the whole MO for the war on drugs and the rationale behind it and the specific substances that have been singled out. But that actually is a great segue into this work that I had the pleasure of doing with Dr. Matt Johnson, who is my postdoctoral mentor when I left my PhD program. And specifically, he had this idea, if psychedelics can be used for addiction treatment, why don't we use it to treat the addiction that's killing the most people, which is tobacco? And it's never been studied for that before, so let's check it out. And, he designed a study, got the ball rolling on that. Of course, was very busy. Things tend to be busy here. And when I got here, they kind of handed off the project to me and say, this is, what we're doing, and we want you to wrap this up so we can see, what do the findings look like? Does this warrant more research? So that was an awesome project to be a part of. I got here and they had run about 5 people so far, and they, kind of showed me the ropes, explained to me how this needed to be done. And then I did, over the next couple of years, the process of cognitive behavioral therapy with high-dose psilocybin administration and 10 more treatment-seeking cigarette smokers who made up a final sample of 15 people who went through the study treatment. And then we just kind of kept tabs on them through 12 months after their quit day, which was the first day that we administered a moderately high dose of psilocybin. And what we found was that a big majority of those people who went through that program were able to stay abstinent from cigarettes for 6 months and then up to a year later. We had 80% success rate at that 6 month time point, which was pretty much unprecedented in the tobacco smoking cessation literature. And even still, a year or more later, we're getting over half of these people still smoke free, it's biochemically verified. So, that was proof of concept study, meaning we didn't have a control group. It was open label. We really just wanted to see if we give cigarette smokers who want to quit high dose psychedelics with a structured program to help them quit, is that going to make them any more likely to quit than you would expect from just that program alone? And the 80% success rate was more than you'd see with pretty much any other treatment. And so that was really awesome to get those data published in 2014. And it really kind of kicked us off into doing a lot more work on that, which we're in the midst of now, randomized comparative efficacy trial, where we have, in the mid 70s of people who have been enrolled in the study, about half have been assigned to receive a single high dose of psilocybin. The other half have been assigned to receive nicotine patches. Everybody's getting the same CBT that we used in the first trial. And again, we're kind of following people out into the 3, 6, and 12 months after the quit day to see how they're doing. And we haven't gotten to our final sample of about 100, I think we're aiming for. But we hope to be there around this time next year. We'll see, because COVID slowed things down for everybody, but certainly for clinical research. And then the other really exciting development there is that You know, Matt Johnson, myself, some of our colleagues here at Hopkins, Justin Strickland, and also other researchers with who have been studying psychedelics and psilocybin for addictions, Michael Bogenschutz at NYU and Peter Hendricks at University of Alabama, Birmingham. We submitted a grant together as a group to do another study of psilocybin for smoking cessation. And that went to the NIH, National Institutes of Health, which is the US government funding mechanism for scientific research. And they had not been funding therapeutic research on psychedelics for some time. I believe it's been probably about 50 years now. And so we were really happy to see that we got that funding come through. Matt Johnson's PI on that project now that's being funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, and then we're going to be kind of continuing to follow up on this work with another study that's got the backing of the US government, which is, again, I think indicative of a really major sea change in terms of how not just the general public, but also the scientific community is viewing the potential of this work.
So you've been talking about all these psychedelic compounds that are being researched. I was really interested in the FDA phase 3 MDMA clinical trials on PTSD. That was really exciting. What else are you excited about? Because I know you're doing great work, but what other types of psychedelic research is exciting you?
Well, you know, I think probably that, you know, MAPS and MDMA for PTSD work is some of the most exciting because it's also furthest along in terms of getting it through this regulatory approval process. And so that's going to be a big deal. Should we get data, which so far the first phase 3 trial supports very strongly that this is a safe and efficacious treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And they're in the midst of doing a second phase 3 trial now. But when those data come back, if everything still looks the way that it did in the first phase 3 study, we're likely going to see a change in the scheduling status of MDMA to become medically approved and available treatment for PTSD. So that's really exciting. And I'm a big fan of Rick Doblin and Michael Mithauber and Annie Mithauber and all the folks who've been working on this for years to get it to this point. But, you know, there's so much more to be learned. And, you know, we're working on, you know, the smoking cessation work here, as I mentioned, but we're really starting to sort of branch out and explore different types of conditions that may or may not be useful, you know, where psychedelics may or may not be useful. And so we're studying psilocybin now in a range of different conditions, including anorexia nervosa, early stage Alzheimer's disease. We're going to be looking at chronic Lyme disease next year. So really a lot of different types of conditions that aren't really what you would consider your traditional neuropsychiatric issues. And so I think as we start to go outside the box and look at other types of health conditions, it's going to inform not only, you know, where we can and where we can't use this effectively, but teach us more about the mechanisms behind psilocybin and these various disease processes. You know, we're also excited. I know, you know, there has been very little work, at least in the US, with LSD since again, probably the 1970s in terms of human clinical research. And so I know Matt Johnson has been trying to get a new study of LSD for chronic pain treatment up and running. And I think that will be very interesting to see how that pans out. And then, you know, there's loads of other groups working on other conditions that we're, you know, haven't really studied before, as well as trying to design and test new intervention strategies, including group types of interventions. I'm trying to, you know, just think of all the long list of people and conditions that are being studied. But, you know, a lot of the work right now is focusing, I would say, primarily on psilocybin among the classic psychedelics and MDMA with, you know, PTSD. And some of that has to do with the regulatory hurdles which are in place in order to use these substances in human trials, which would make it difficult and a lengthy and expensive process to get some of these other drugs into those phases of trials. But I do think we will see work with mescaline. There has been great work with ayahuasca, mostly done in South America, but I think that would be something else to study. There's good data to suggest ayahuasca, just like the other classic psychedelics, has a good potential for treating mood disorders, substance use disorders. And then all these other compounds that were, either just beginning to study in human trials, like 5-MeO-DMT, 2-CB, some of these phenethylamines that are from the Shulgin Library, that haven't made it through to formal human clinical trials, but they represent a sort of new horizon for us to explore, pharmacologically and medically. So I think, that's where the future of the field is, yes, we're going to see more research with psilocybin. Yes, we're going to see potential MDMA, treatments out there in the world, not too long from now. But that just opens up the door to all this other kind of encyclopedia of substances that we don't know that much about, and that could have a lot of real significant therapeutic potential. So that's exciting, not to mention all the other sort of configurations of those molecules or tweaks on those substances that could come, could be forthcoming and also have their own sort of risk-benefit profiles.
So just in closing, I was hoping you could touch on this. As psychedelics kind of go through this FDA clearance for safety and efficacy and no longer a Schedule I drug, there's a lot of, emphasis on treating pathology, treating this disease. And you had kind of mentioned that, maybe we should also be talking about what psychedelics can do for interpersonal growth. We see this use of psychedelics, as you were saying, for centuries with indigenous populations for this very reason. What do you feel is kind of the role of psychedelics in that space?
Yeah, when you're talking about the Western medical model, you're talking about addressing pathology. And so you're going to have an illness or a disease state, and the patient is going to come to the doctor to seek out a treatment for relief of that specific condition. And that's fine. And I think it has its place. But the kind of longer arc of history here has really been kind of a traditional ritual or spiritual type of use, at least among indigenous cultures. And I, have seen a resurgence of that. We've seen a resurgence of that really in things like ayahuasca churches that have been becoming more popular, not just, in South America, but here in, in the US as well. And so I think that there is a real interest and need for people to have these types of experiences in different types of settings that may not be medically oriented. And so someone who's going to an ayahuasca church or is having an experience in a different type of setting, is probably looking for a different type of experience. And I don't think we should necessarily close a book on that and say, well, you can use it if a doctor is sitting there, but if you're doing it as part of your religious tradition, we don't advocate that. Because that's been happening longer than there's been doctors, at least of the type that we know of. And then, of course, I think the other thing is that there's sort of this very neat kind of medical use package over here. There's more of a nebulous, but, long history of traditional use. And, that's for more of these ritualistic or spiritual purposes. And you have, of course, talking back about Woodstock, what has often been thought of as recreational use. I don't like that term because it really diminishes what people are doing there, but I think that it has a real potential value for people to enjoy their lives and have fun, which I don't think is necessarily needs to be a crime. And again, if you're going to a happy hour, you're doing something that's generally pretty similar or comparable at least. And so at least when I was growing up in South Florida, the 1990s, there's a huge rave scene, electronic dance music. And I think for people who were born in my generation, that was like the Woodstock of the older generations. I mean, really, it's about people seeking out sort of ecstatic experience, people seeking out connection with others and with the community. And I think that there's a real role for that, and that psychedelic use, you know, there's a cultural history of that here in the US when you're going back to the 1960s. And, you know, to make it a criminal and illegal activity, it raises a question of why, and, you know, why is that illegal when other types of recreational substance use is not? It's worthwhile thinking about how people use these substances, why they could be used in different ways, why, you know, our culture might react and respond in certain ways to, yeah, that's okay, but that's not okay. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah, you know, if you got a person who's dealing with a serious depression or addiction, you might be able to help them in a medical setting by using this as a treatment. Then I think the kind of clear answer there is, if it works and it's safe, then why not? But when we're going to some of these religious or spiritual uses, or what, you know, is often thought of as recreational use, I wonder, you know, why would we say people should not do this or people cannot do this? And I struggle to come up with a very good rationale.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of The Hidden Body. If you have enjoyed the message of this podcast, please tell two other people to listen. This is the best way to help spread the word. Also, subscribe to the podcast and leave a 5-star review so that others who are looking for this kind of information can find it. This is a space for educational discussion and should not be taken as medical advice. This podcast represents the opinions of myself and my guests. Please consult with the appropriate medical professional for any medical questions regarding your health.